Probably the book of Exodus is the second most familiar book of the Old Testament. Second, because it follows the book of Genesis. In the book of Genesis, more people know concerning what is recorded in the book of Genesis than virtually any other book of the Old Testament. But the book of Exodus is that which we know a great deal about because of a couple of the events that take place. For example, the delivering of the children of Israel from Pharaoh bondage, and then the giving of the law at Mount Sinai. And yet there's a great deal in the book of Exodus that we are not familiar with, generally speaking. At least not as familiar with as we are those other two occasions. It's important for us to recognize that from the close of the book of Genesis to the opening of Exodus chapter 1, verse 1, we have, and it fluctuates as far as opinion is concerned, but somewhere in the neighborhood of about 280 years have passed by from the close of Genesis to the opening of the book of Exodus. The very word Exodus itself means going out, or also carries with it the idea of departure. And the name for this particular book, as was the case with the name for the book of Genesis, comes from the Septuagint version, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures that was done about 160 BC. And that's where we have the current name that has been passed on down to us of the book of Genesis. The Jews do not call it the book of Exodus. Rather, they call it the book Shemoth, which simply means names, because that's how the opening phrase in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. And they oftentimes labeled their books according to the beginning of the book. And since verse 1 begins, now these are the names of the children of Israel. That's where they called it Shemoth, the names. And as such, it is known to them by that. Most everyone accepts that Moses is the human author of the book of Exodus. Of course, we know that it's inspired. We know that Moses is writing by inspiration when he writes the book. But it is generally accepted that Moses is the writer, and more than once in the book of Exodus, it states that God tells him to write these things down. Exodus chapter 17, verse 14, and chapter 24, verse 4. And when you look at the New Testament, Jesus and others in New Testament times confirmed that Moses was the one who did the writing of this particular book. Mark chapter 1, verse 44, and John chapter 7, verses 19 through 22. The emphasis of the book of Exodus is different from the book of Genesis. And in Exodus, it reveals that God makes a shift in his emphasis. In the book of Genesis, we have the emphasis being upon individuals. And when you go throughout the book of Genesis, that is the way that it is. But with the book of Exodus, we now turn from individuals to the beginning of a nation. The nation of Israel, the nation of the children of Israel. And as a result of this, we are going to have God over his chosen people as a nation, being those who are the descendants of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. Concerning the purpose of the book of Exodus, it again takes up with the idea of a particular family, the descendants of Jacob, the descendants of Israel, who had come down into Egypt at the close of the book of Genesis because of the famine that was not just in Egypt, but throughout this entire area. And Joseph, being in Egypt, is a deliverer for his own people, whereby Pharaoh extends the invitation for Joseph's family, 70 in number, to come down into Egypt, and they will be taken care of. They were given the land known as the land of Goshen. and they were isolated. They were isolated from the rest of the Egyptians for a large period of time, and one of the reasons as to their isolation in the closing of the book of Genesis is because they are shepherds. The Egyptians didn't like shepherds. Shepherds were considered to be the low class of individuals, and so they didn't want to associate with those who were shepherds. And so it was absolutely fine with the Egyptians for the Israelites to be in the land of Goshen. Keep them away from us was the idea. Of course, eventually that is going to change as we get into the introduction to the book of Genesis, because the children of Israel have now grown to be such a large number, and the Pharaoh who rules in Egypt is one who does not know of Joseph. And remember, 280 years approximately have passed since the closing of the book of Genesis, and indications are, as far as history is concerned, that the Pharaoh that is now on the throne with the opening of the book of Exodus is not of even the same family as the Pharaoh who was on the throne when Joseph was alive. We have had a couple changes in the Pharaoh dynasty, or the dynasty, whichever way you want to pronounce that. And so we have an entirely different family now who is on the throne over Egypt. At the time of the Exodus, therefore, he is described as one who did not know Joseph. This book furnishes a vivid description of God delivering the children of Israel from this Egyptian bondage. And certainly that's one of those areas that we're very familiar with. But not only does he do that, he also brings into being a covenant with this people. And one of the things to remember concerning a covenant, and this is going to be true as you examine the Old Testament, one of the things concerning a covenant is we often think of it as being a contract. Mr. Lawyer back here makes all kinds of contracts. And in making those contracts, you have an agreement between both sides that this is what's going to happen. The problem is, a covenant is not a contract, per se, as we think of a contract. It is a one-sided contract. When God made a covenant, he said, this is the way it's going to be. Now, you either accept it or you reject it, but this is the way it's going to be. And, at least for a period of time, the children of Israel followed it. They accepted it. They were willing to do, so they stated, all the words of the Lord, all the will of the Lord. But, of course, we know that that didn't follow through. But it is not such that it has to have agreement on both sides. As far as this covenant is concerned, God devised the covenant. God made the covenant, and he said, if you're going to be my people, this is what the way it's going to happen. And this is what you're going to have to do in following me and being my people. And so with this, there is this special relationship between God and the children of Israel, and it is such that even here in Exodus chapter 19 and in verse 5, they will be described as a peculiar treasure to the Lord. And such they were. There is a national purpose here in the book of Exodus, of course, because at this point, Old Testament history changes from being a family religion to being a national religion. And that God is going to be over the children of Israel. He is going to be their king. And as such, he is their lawmaker. And with this as well is the fact that the law that he is going to give to the children of Israel is not only a religious law, it is a national law. God incorporates into this covenant, into the law, not only things that pertain to religion, but also that pertain to the government, because the very same law was over both. Over them as people of God, but also over the nation as being a separate identity, a separate nation from the nations around them. It tells us how that God came down in his grace to deliver this enslaved people. Remember, in the opening chapters, we're going to have concerning the taskmasters. We had not read concerning taskmasters in the book of Genesis. And in fact, in very few places throughout the remainder of the Old Testament do we read concerning taskmasters. But they are prevalent here in Egypt in the opening chapters of the book of Exodus. And it is because of the taskmasters and the way that they conduct themselves in their inner association with the children of Israel that the children of Israel are going to cry unto the Lord for a deliverer, to deliver them from these taskmasters and the treatment that they are receiving, even though the treatment they are receiving is that which is endorsed and supported by Pharaoh, in fact, encouraged by the Pharaoh that rules. And it ends, the book of Exodus ends by declaring how that God came down to dwell with the children of Israel in the tabernacle in the midst of this redeemed people that God has redeemed to himself here in the book of Exodus. Basically, the book of Exodus can be divided into three sections. And we'll notice a little bit later in giving an outline concerning the book of Exodus that we're going to divide it differently. So there's more than one way to divide it. But it can be divided according to Israel in Egypt, Exodus chapter 1, verse 1 through chapter 12, verse 36. Israel in its journey, Exodus chapter 12, verse 37 through chapter 18, verse 27. And Israel at Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 19 through the remainder of the book, chapter 40. What are some keys to the book of Exodus? Well, the key words in the book of Exodus would be the words of deliverance and the word law. These play a prominent part throughout the book of Exodus, as you would expect, with God delivering them from Egyptian bondage, and having delivered them from the Egyptian bondage, now he gives them a law whereby he is going to govern them. The key verses of the book of Exodus, mainly, you could come up with several different keys, probably, but Exodus chapter 3, verse 8, where there it says, I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them out of the land, out of that land, unto a good land and large, unto a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. There, God tells us what his intent is, what his purpose is going to be, and such is what the remainder of the book of Exodus is all about. Key chapters, chapters 12, 13, and 14 of the book of Exodus, as it relates to the actual deliverance of the children of Israel from this Egyptian bondage. The key phrase, which is used several times in the book of Exodus, is, "Let my people go." You've probably heard the song that emphasizes that very phrase, that very point. Let my people go in speaking to Pharaoh. That's certainly the key phrase in the book of Exodus. The key message. Again, we said there's a change in emphasis. In the book of Genesis, it speaks concerning man's failure under the many tests and conditions that were there and how that God repented himself of having made man. In the book of Exodus, here we show that God remembers man, remembers the descendants of Abraham from the book of Genesis, and sets about to rescue and to redeem his chosen people, the Israelites, the descendants of Israel. Something that I put here that is interesting, and it is a key to remember, and that is when you notice Exodus chapter 12 and go through Exodus chapter 40, those 28 chapters, 29 including chapter 12 itself, those 29 chapters cover 1 year's time, about 1 year. From the time of the leaving of Egypt until the time that they are at Mount Sinai. We have, after, of course, the law is given not once but twice, and the tabernacle is constructed and the various things such as that. They will still be at Mount Sinai at the close of the book of Exodus, but we have about a year that has transpired in those 29 different chapters. If you wanted a summary of the book of Exodus as far as what is recorded in the book itself, certainly the summary would come from Exodus chapter 19. Because there in chapter 19, verses 4 through 6, God says to Moses, "Ye have seen what I did unto the Egyptians, and how I bare you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel." And there in capsulized form is the whole book. God reminds them what they were like when they were still in Egypt and how that he brings them out of Egypt. And now he is going to govern them and be over them and provide a law for them whereby they will be his covenant people, his peculiar treasure, different from all others, different from everyone else that was alive at that particular time. When you break the book down, you end up having two main sections. The first 19 chapters end up being a historical section, as far, even though all of it is actually history, but as far as the children of Israel being in Egypt and their deliverance from Egypt. And then beginning in chapter 20 and going through the final chapter of chapter 40, you end up having the legislative section. By that, we simply mean this is where God begins to give his law to his people. And he gives all of those different commandments. Now, we often think concerning the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, rightfully so. And unfortunately, much of the religious world believes that basically the Ten Commandments were all there were, but they weren't. In fact, as you notice there at the bottom, God actually gives them about 613 commandments. 613 different commandments. Some 245 were thou shalt, you are permitted to do these things. 368 were thou shalt not, you cannot do these things. Sometimes we hear brethren say, we shouldn't emphasize the negative. Or, as they generally put it, don't be negative. I always find that interesting. They're negative in saying you shouldn't be negative. But isn't it interesting that of the laws that God gave, the majority of them were thou shalt not. They were negatives, even though they were for positive reasons. And so with this, it is significant that in thinking concerning the Ten Commandments, the other 603 commandments actually end up falling under one of these Ten Commandments in one form or fashion. Anyway, the Ten Commandments end up almost being general categories of commandments that all the others end up falling under. And so you have commandments that covered morality. You had commandments that covered the ceremonial aspect of things. You had commandments that covered the civil aspects. You had commandments that covered the social interaction relationship. And all of these things were commandments that God gave to the children of Israel in order to make them a peculiar people, a peculiar treasure to himself. They were divine directions that were given even to the establishment of the priesthood, the leaders of the worship of the Jews, and even concerning the construction and the use of the tabernacle. Tabernacle has not been used before now. Tabernacle has not been spoken of before now. This is something that God is going to institute with the book of Genesis. Well, when you consider the book itself and break it down into an outline form, remembering that the word Exodus means going out or going anyway, determination to be made as to what kind of going we're talking about, it's interesting to use that idea, the name itself, Exodus, or going, to notice a breakdown of the book. And so we have, first of all, a going out of Egypt, the deliverance from Egyptian bondage. Exodus chapter 1 through chapter 15, verse 22. Here, of course, as we begin the book of Exodus, we notice that the children of Israel, the Israelites are slaves. They are treated as slaves. They are treated with little and no respect. Pharaoh is one who is so concerned about the number of Israelites in the country that he has set out to control the population of the children of Israel. He has, if you remember, petitioned, in fact, required of the midwives that if there was a baby boy that was born, that boy was to be killed. And therefore control population growth through these means. Now, the midwives didn't do it. And, of course, if you remember, their explanation was that these Jewish women, you know, they're strange creatures. They call for us midwives to come, and by the time we get there, the baby's already born. So we can't kill it. The idea behind it, of course, was that as it was being born, it was to be killed if it was a male, and that way control the population. But the midwives did not follow through on that. But here at the beginning of the book of Exodus, we have this going out as far as the deliverance is concerned. Moses is such that he is taken into Pharaoh's house, Exodus chapter 2. Remember that Amram and Jochebed, Moses' parents, concealed Moses until he was 3 months of age, rather than having him put to death, as Pharaoh had instructed was supposed to be done. And then Jochebed, of course, is going to put him in this ark of bulrushes and lay him there in the stream close to shore, close to where Pharaoh's daughter goes to bathe every day, and with the hopes that she is going to see the baby Moses and that she will draw him out. By the way, do you know what Moses means? Drawn out. That's right. Drawn out because he was taken out of the Nile. That's what his name means. Someone has asked and inquired, and I've often found it curious myself, why is it? And I don't remember if we've talked about this before, but why is it when Pharaoh has given a law that all the Jewish males are to be killed when they are born? And Moses is a Jewish male. And Pharaoh's daughter is going to find Moses here in the river among the bulrushes. Why is it Pharaoh's daughter did not kill Moses, obeying her father? Did you ever wonder about that? Why? It seems, even though babies are very precious, irresistible. You just can't. Though certainly we have some in our society that are working on doing it and have done it for many years. If you have any ounce of real feeling in you, you just can't turn your back on a baby. Doesn't matter what its background is. Doesn't matter what its situation is. There is that appeal, irresistibility for infants. And so maybe that was the reason. But I came across something else, and I didn't put it in the outline, but I just thought I'd pass it along to you. Won't even charge you for it. Another aspect that becomes, I believe, very significant in thinking concerning Moses. According to the religion of the Egyptians, remember that they worshiped just about everything. Everything from the Nile River to the sun god to the moon god and all kinds of different animal gods. And, of course, that is important when you consider the plagues that God is going to bring upon the Egyptians. That, in fact, God is going to show that all of their gods are really nothing. They are not real gods, and each one of the plagues is God, Jehovah God, demonstrating, I am the one who has power. I am the only one who has power. And all of these beings that you believe in and that you bow down to and give obeisance to, they are nothing. They can't stop me. I control it all. But in their religion, one of the things that takes place, so I am told, and it certainly makes sense to me anyway, is the oldest daughter of Pharaoh was one who was ceremonially and, as far as they were concerned, literally married to the Nile god, the god of the Nile. And so Pharaoh's oldest daughter becomes the wife of the Nile god. Now, with this, the Nile is an extremely important part of the nation of Egypt. The Nile, every year, in fact, twice a year, overflows its banks. And even though we would consider flooding as this kind of thing to be a destructive thing, it was not. Because it allowed the various fertilizing material that was in the river to be brought up on the land in order to make it fertile for the crops. And so every time the Nile overflowed its banks, they praised the god of the Nile. They worshiped the god of the Nile because he gave them this bounty for the crops that were going to be sown. Anything that came from the Nile was considered to be a gift from their god. What happens when you have a little Jewish boy that comes down the Nile? This little Jewish boy ends up being a gift from the Nile god to his wife, Pharaoh's daughter, who was the one who came down and bathed every day in this particular river. Why did she not kill him? This was a gift from her husband. Now, doesn't that make sense? You ever thought about that before? I hadn't. I ran across it by accident. But once I saw it, I said, boy, that makes all the sense in the world. That would certainly explain why Moses was not killed and why he will be brought up in Pharaoh's household as if he is a grandson to Pharaoh himself, even though everybody knows he's not. He's a Jewish boy. And yet he will be raised as Pharaoh's grandson. Like I said, no charge for that. Pharaoh, his heart is going to be hardened when Moses returns to deliver the children of Israel. And it's interesting when you go through and you notice there are different descriptions that are given. At one point, it's stated that God hardens Pharaoh's heart. At another point, it's stated that Pharaoh hardens his own heart. And at another point, it's stated that the magicians and the astrologers that Pharaoh has, they harden his heart. Question is often raised, well, who actually hardened it? Well, in the ultimate end, Pharaoh hardened his own heart. God did it through the miracles that were performed, whereby every miracle that came about, Pharaoh would relent for just a few seconds and then he would change his mind and he'd say, absolutely not, I'm not going to follow through with it. And by such, he would harden his own heart. His magicians, when they attempted, at least in the first couple of plagues anyway, when they attempted to do the very same thing, Pharaoh decided, well, there's no sense listening to Moses and to Aaron. My magicians can do the same thing. And therefore, they really didn't have the power that they claimed to have. But of course, we know that ultimately the magicians stopped trying because they could no longer duplicate what God was doing. And as a result, Pharaoh will continue to harden his heart. But along the way, as you read the book of Exodus, you notice that Pharaoh begins to try to compromise. You know, when God tells you to do something and you don't really want to do it, then it's not uncommon to try to get around it with a compromise position. And certainly Pharaoh does that on four different occasions anyway. He tries to compromise with what Moses has come to petition him for. And every time, of course, the compromise is going to fail. It's not going to be accepted. And ultimately, the children of Israel are going to be delivered from Egypt, and it won't be because Pharaoh wants it to happen this way. It will be because this is the way that, with the miracles coming from God, that it will come about, even though Pharaoh did not really want them to leave. Chapter 15, verses 1 through 22, we have the song of deliverance that is sung as they are going out and being delivered, crossing the Red Sea. Then we have the going forward, the journeyings into the wilderness. The wilderness, as far as the beginning of the wilderness wanderings, we don't find out in the book of Genesis why they end up wandering for 40 years. But here we have the beginnings of these journeys, Exodus chapter 15 through chapter 19, verse 2. And their arrival ultimately at Mount Sinai, where the law is going to be given to them. From there, we have the going with God, the acceptance of the covenant that God gives to them, their willingness to comply with it, Exodus chapter 19, verse 3 through chapter 24, verse 11. And with this covenant, it is between God and the Israelites. And one of the points that Moses will make more than once in the process of delivering this, and it's reiterated in the book of Deuteronomy, is this law is for them, those who have been delivered from Egypt. It was not given to their fathers. It is for them and for their descendants that will follow after them. It is a new law. It is a peculiar law. It is that which is for these who have been delivered from bondage and for their descendants. It included, as we stated, Exodus chapter 20, the Ten Commandments. But then there are many other, 603 approximately, though all of them are not listed in the book of Exodus, by the way, but some 603 other related covenant commandments that are given. And with these, God will say, I will bless you. And the Israelites, in turn, responded by, we will obey you, though we know that it didn't always take and it didn't always last. Then there is the going to God by way of worship through the tabernacle that they received instructions from God on how it was to be constructed, and that the fact that it was in the tabernacle where they are going to offer their worship to God up until the time when Solomon is going to build the temple in 1 Kings. And so with this, we have the going to God. But then when you look at the book of Genesis in chapter 32, we have the going from God, the going away from God, in that they follow after this calf that they had asked Aaron to fashion for them. And that this, you remember, Moses has been up on Mount Sinai receiving the law from God, and he's been up there for such a long time. We don't know if he's ever coming down. We don't know what's happened to him. And so Aaron, fashion this calf. Take this gold. Take these earrings that we have. Fashion this calf, and this will be our God, and this will be the God that will that has delivered us out of Egypt. You see, the children of Israel had left Egypt, but unfortunately, Egypt had not left the children of Israel. They carried this idea of this false god, which was one of the gods the Egyptians worshipped, in order to make it their god. And as such, they have already broken the first two commandments that God has given to Moses, not to have any other gods before him and not to bow down to any graven image. They've broken both of those already. And there were only 10 to start with. Two are already broken. Then we have, with the remainder of the book of Exodus, the going back to God. Remember, as a result of their going away from God, God is going to punish the children of Israel because of this. And so they are going to have to repent. They are going to have to return to God. And in the process of doing that, they will also build the tabernacle whereby they will worship Jehovah God. God warns them concerning the fact that they must repent in order to return, in order to be his people. And as Moses returns to the mount the second time, because he broke those commandments when he came down and saw what they were doing the first time, and therefore they have to be inscribed again, they have to be done again, he goes up the second time into the mount, and there he will receive the covenant renewed. And as a result, the tabernacle, the instructions for the tabernacle are going to be given. The tabernacle is going to be built. And the worship to God in the tabernacle will begin at the close of the book. It's interesting when you look at the book of Exodus. There are many people who do not believe that the book really tells factual matters, just as they try to say virtually any of the books of the Bible are not factual. It's just myth. It's just been recorded, and especially the book of Genesis, as we noted before. But there are many of those who do not believe that the things recorded in the book of Exodus are history, historical facts. But it is interesting, is it not? And we're not going to go through all of them necessarily that are here, but of the things that are recorded in the book of Exodus, how the New Testament writers confirmed these events. For example, the increase population-wise of the Israelites, Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. Stephen speaks concerning that, Acts chapter 7, verse 17. The oppression of Israel, Exodus chapter 1, verse 11, with the taskmasters. Again, Stephen refers to it in Acts chapter 7, verses 18 and 19, and also verse 34. Then you have concerning the birth and the preservation and the training of Moses, Exodus chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, and confirmation of that in Acts chapter 7 and in the book of Hebrews. Then Moses slaying the Egyptian and fleeing into the land of Midian, Exodus chapter 2, verses 11 through 15, also confirmed, Acts chapter 7 and Hebrews chapter 11. The call of Moses to go back to Egypt in order to deliver the children of Israel from bondage, Exodus chapter 3, verse 10, is confirmed in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Acts, and the book of Romans concerning that event. Then you have the plagues in Egypt, Exodus chapter 7 through chapter 11, and confirmed in Romans chapter 9. You have the Passover that is instituted, Exodus chapter 12, which is referred to by Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, as well as Hebrews chapter 9 and chapter 11. You have the firstborn that is sanctified, Exodus chapter 13, spoken of in Luke chapter 2. And on and on and on you can go, and there are more than 20 of them that are listed here. I didn't count them all. And using letters, I can't tell you what that is, but about 25, actually, I guess, pretty much, listed here. And so the significance is that the New Testament, including Jesus himself, confirmed that which was spoken about in the book of Exodus as being actual events. And therefore, we can have assurance concerning the things that are recorded in the book of Exodus. When you look at the book very quickly, you also notice how it pictures God. And we notice this concerning the book of Genesis, the different ways that God is portrayed in the book of Genesis. Well, the same is true in the book of Exodus. Here he is portrayed as the supreme ruler over all nature. That's what the 10 plagues were all about, correct? He's portrayed as the one who has power over Pharaoh and therefore power over all kings and all nations. And certainly Paul emphasizes that very same thing. That God is the one who had the right to choose Israel to be his own people if he so wanted to, and that's exactly what he did. And then he had the ability to defend as well as to care for his people, and he did just exactly that in the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus also shows to us chapter 20, verses 2 and 3, with those first two commandments we talked about, emphasizes the fact that Jehovah God is a jealous God. He is not willing to share his people with any other false deity, with any false deity, not any other false deity. That would imply he's a false deity. He's not. With any deity, period, because all other deities are false. And he is a jealous God, and he's not willing to lighten up on that. And that hasn't changed even in New Testament times. He is Jehovah God, the great I Am, the one who is everlasting, who is ever present, ever existent one. That is the God of the Jews that is portrayed in the book of Exodus. Some of the lessons we can learn from the book of Exodus are that God never asks anyone to do what he cannot do. And even though Moses did not think that he could lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, God showed that he could, because God was going to be with him. He wasn't going to leave Moses to do it all on his own. God was going to make sure that what was needed would be supplied to Moses in order to carry it out. God also makes a covenant, a solemn agreement with Israel, and the Israelites pledge themselves to obey it. And one of the interesting points to remember is that from this point on, from the book of Exodus on, God does not take this pledge of the Israelites lightly. He doesn't say, well, you know, that was probably just a minor thought that you had, that you were going to obey my law. No, 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 no. With God, whenever a pledge is made, whenever a commitment is made, you're bound by that. And he recognizes it as such. And therefore, with us, when we are buried with Christ by baptism, we are making a pledge to God. We are committing ourselves to God. And God doesn't look upon that lightly either. God also, in the book of Exodus, gives laws to be obeyed, as we've talked about, concerning the Ten Commandments and all the other laws that basically fall under those ten in one fashion or form. And in the book of Exodus, it also shows to us that God gave detailed instructions concerning the tabernacle where he was going to be worshipped. So many people have the idea that God really could care less as to how he is worshipped or what is involved in worship. That's never been the case. God has always specified exactly what he expected, exactly what would be acceptable to him. He has never left it to man's own imagination. And therefore, he has always governed man through his laws because worship is a serious thing as far as God is concerned. And Exodus contains many types or pictures of the Messiah, the Christ who is to come. Remember the Passover lamb? That was a picture of Christ who was to come. The manna that came from heaven, Jesus used that as an illustration, even speaking concerning himself, that he is the bread from heaven for man in New Testament times. The rock that water gushed for, Jesus is the living water for those of us today. Those were all pictures looking toward the coming of the Christ, the Messiah to come. And so with the book of Exodus, it shows that God wants his people to live more righteously than those that are around them. That is certainly emphasized throughout the book. And God has always given directions governing worship that is offered to him. And as such, as you look at the book, you also notice that we cannot alter God's instructions and be acceptable with God. In fact, we cannot alter God's instructions and be guiltless. God will hold us accountable. And when you, as we emphasized in our overview of the Old Testament, that point is brought out over and over again. You don't change my law. You don't add to it. You don't subtract from it, or you'll suffer the consequences as a result of it. It is also brought out that we will always have enemies. We're not going to have all friends. We are going to have, just as the children of Israel did, we are going to have those who will be our enemies because of who we worship and who we align ourselves with, because there is only one God, no matter what everyone else says. So the book of Exodus, the book of the going out. Going out is certainly the main idea behind the book of Genesis, but certainly it has great, great lessons for us to learn and can help us in our everyday lives as New Testament Christians. Yes, it's a part of the Old Testament. We're not governed by the Old Testament, but we can learn those great lessons from the Old Testament, as Paul says in Romans chapter 15, verse 4. Whatsoever things were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we, through patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope.